All right, so we've got three things that you're into. The Martian, Warhammer 2, Thinking Fast and Slow. In the real world here, there are thousands of movies, thousands of games, and thousands of books. Of course, we know there's more. But even if there's just a thousand of each, when you take those three interests and you put them into something that you like, you let them be inspired by something that you create, that means that the permutations go from you being one in 8 billion people, because there's a billion permutations for just those three things at a thousand each, you become one in eight people in the world. So when you create by putting your interests, you immediately reduce the amount of other people doing things like you, okay? You become one in eight. And then if you add a fourth item, the permutations become a trillion, and that's 128 times the population here. There is no one like you when you take your four interests and put them into what you do.
Hello, PKMers. Welcome back to Personal Knowledge Management with Aiden Halfon, the podcast where I interview fellow PKMers and dive into the unique ways they use their PKM systems for work, creativity, and life.
Joey Caffone is the founder and CEO of Baron Fig, an award-winning designer and entrepreneur, and author of number one best-selling The Laws of Creativity. He's designed and art directed over 100 products from zero to launch, and his work has been featured in Fast Company, Bloomberg, New York Magazine, Newsweek, Bon Appetit, Quartz, Mashable, Print, and more. In this podcast, you will learn the power of niching for creativity, the biggest mistake people make regarding creativity, and why discipline isn't always good for creativity. Joey, I read your book, I would say, like, I think around 4 months ago, and it really, it was definitely earlier than that, like 3 months ago, and it really inspired me a lot. So I'm very excited to talk to you today. And the first question that I wanted to ask is if you could tell us a bit about your story. What led you to design and what keeps you passionate about it to this day?
Yeah. Well, hello, everyone out there. Aiden, thanks for having me on. I appreciate that you read the book, and it sounds like a small thing, but to give your time into something, you know, obviously I hope you got something from it, but it's just so beautiful that you took your time to consume something that I made, which is an honor, something I'm thankful for every single person who does that. So thank you. Seriously, that is something I probably will never get totally comfortable with hearing, because it seems like such a gift. You know, when I was writing this thing, it was a bit of a mystery. I'm like, is anybody going to read this? Anyone going to like it? And then, as you said, it went to number one on Amazon. So anyway, the question is, what is my story and why did I write the book? Is that right?
That, yeah, it's like, what led you to getting into creativity in the first place, and what keeps you passionate about it to this day?
Sure. So this is going to be a story that you're familiar with because it's in the intro, but it really is the turning point in my life. So there was a day in first grade when I was 7 years old, when I walked into the class, and maybe you remember from the intro, where the teacher handed out these worksheets with the little cartoon worms, and she said, color them up, put them on the bulletin board, you know, cut them out and everything. And so I colored mine. For some reason, I remember I had my arm around my worksheet, like, I'm going to make the best. No one better look at mine, right? And I'm coloring and coloring away. I cut it out. I walk up to the bulletin board, and I guess I took a long time because most folks' worms were up there by then. And I realized that mine wasn't different. Like, we were all using the same crayons, and sure, the colors were like applied differently, but as a group, they still looked just so uniform. So I go back to my desk, and I almost cried. You know, 7-year-old Joey was quite an emotional little dude, I guess. And I was, what am I going to do? And I'm looking down, and I see these shards of paper that I cut out. The worm. And so a light ticks on, and I realize I could use them. And so I drew a boombox, a microphone, and a necklace. I put it on my worm. I accessorized him, and I put that on the board. And this is the pivotal pivotal moment. This is where everything changed. The teacher came up behind me, and I'll never forget, she kind of stood there quiet, and I was like, man, am I going to get yelled at for doing this? Like, it's kind of outside the bounds of the rules. But instead, and I give her credit because she could have gone either way as a teacher, and she said, this is amazing. I've never seen anything like it. And then everybody gathered around, was like, whoa, so cool. And from that day forward, I was addicted to the feeling of doing something different, like genuinely wanted to find the next hit of when I could do something where people go, whoa, so cool. And so you fast forward now, oh man, almost 30 years where I've been doing this my entire life in a keen focus on it too. This is a main driver of everything I do. When I went through grammar school and into high school and college and then beyond, I always was trying to be different and seeing what that was like. So I worked that muscle super hard, starting super young. And by the time I, turned the corner on my 30s, I really understood how to make things different, how people responded. I built a company, Baron Fig, around it. And it was inevitable that I needed to write a book about it because it dawned on me that I had quite a unique experience with creativity and doing things different. And so when the pandemic hit, my wife was like, if you don't write this now, you're never going to write it. And so I did.
I think one of the things that your story really hit home for me about is how most people don't think that they're capable of being the person who can create that unique looking worm. That thing that's different. And I'm interested to hear, what do you think it is that allowed you to create that or step into your creative potential? Whereas most people, they never fully accept that creative part of themselves.
That's a really good question. And you're only the third person out of dozens and dozens to ask me that. The first one was my wife during our practice run of podcast interviews that we did before the book launch. She interviewed me and she goes, so why do you think you did this and not other people? And I gave her an answer and she was like, that answer sucks. Don't tell anybody that. Like, I don't like it. And I'm like, but I think this is the truth. And she's like, no, that's bullshit. And I'm going to tell you anyway. So I'm sorry, Ariana, if she's listening.
Oh, man. Make sure she doesn't listen to this podcast.
I know, right? She's gonna be like, I told you not to tell people this. And the reason that I think I was primed to make that moment work for me was because of my personal experience leading up to that as being taller than everyone else. And now I know you're like, what the hell are you talking about, dude? So I'm 6'3". And back in the day, I was head and shoulders above everyone else. I grew fast. So I was 6'3 by the time I was in eighth grade. So I grew super quick. And it was awkward. But what that gave to me was, unfortunately, the inability to hide. And so there are times when you want to blend in and you don't want people to look at you. But as the tallest person in the room, the tallest kid in the room all the time, everyone was always watching me. And so I got really comfortable with attention. And specifically when I would do something stupid and silly, I couldn't hide it because people were like, oh, Joey, you dumbass. And so I got comfortable with trying things publicly, let's say, and just sort of laying it out there because I couldn't avoid it as, the tall person. And so my wife didn't like this because she was like, well, if people aren't tall, does that mean they can't be creative? And it's like, absolutely not. Everybody has their own path towards creativity and being comfortable with putting themselves out there, right? Like there are every podcaster who's doing, what you're doing is putting themselves out there. They're not all 6'3". It's just, that was my personal path. And so that's my answer, is that just being kind of all eyes on me so often allowed me to say, well, screw it. What can I lose? And I was more comfortable with that idea earlier on than I think most folks.
Wow. Well, as a Dutch person that is 3 inches shorter than the average Dutch person, I'm personally offended by that. I'm kidding. No, that actually, that makes so much sense. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but one way that you could see why being tall gave you that ability is you're just looking at the world through a different lens, which doesn't require you to be tall. It just requires you to have a different perspective when you're coming to a piece of information. Whether that be like, you know, maybe I know this is one of the laws in the book. I can't remember what exactly it is, but just like coming to something, maybe like an industry, a piece of information, using a frame from a different industry or a different thing. And it just lets you see it so completely differently than
like the law of connection, I think, which is to take
disparate
ideas and put them together. Yeah. Well said.
You know, based off of that, honestly, I think a fun question would be, what do you think is the biggest thing people get wrong about creativity?
Oh, this is a good one, man. So when I was first interviewing folks before I wrote the book, so I wanted to really understand, you know, are people interested in this subject, number one, and then number two, what do they want to know about it? So like when I started Baron Fig in 2013, I asked people one question, which is, what do you want in a notebook? And I asked 400 people and I got incredible insight and I was able to make Baron Fig because of that. So I was like, let me do the same thing. So I asked a question starting the book. I said, what do you wish you knew about creativity? And I'm thinking going into this that folks are like, oh, where do I start, or what does the process look like from start to finish in making something, right? Like the literal creating of something. And that was originally the book that I intended to write, was actually just part two, which was how to create from start to finish. That's the middle part. What I realized is that most people know how to create from start to finish, but their perspective, like you said, their perspective on themselves and on creating is the part that needs tuning. And so that was such a revelation, because if I didn't do that, I would have written a totally different book. And I realized that I needed to first create a part one about mindset, where I lay a foundation which helps people see that they are creative and understand what creativity actually is. Because most people think creativity is creating, right? But it's actually a misnomer. You don't really create. You connect. You take disparate ideas and you put them together. So in the book, I think I have a couple of examples. It's like the iPhone was a phone plus a computer, two separate ideas connected. Pokemon, one of the top franchises, media franchises in the world, is just putting together our fascination with fantasy worlds and our love of our pets. And so the idea that I wanted to get early on was, like I said, you are creative, and creativity is not creating, it's combining. And that's what a lot of people stumble on. And when they understand that, it's like you can light a fire under them and they're like, I'm ready. I get it. Let's do it.
That's so interesting that when you first sent out the questions for the book, like you were fully thinking it was all going to be about, you know, how do you actually create? And that's not at all what the case was. You know, from my experience, I totally see that with the people around me that are trying to get into doing something creative as well, because my brother and my mom have both recently started YouTube channels themselves, and they continually, especially my brother, will say things like, you know, oh, like what gives me the right to create this on YouTube? And I'm like, you literally have the experience of someone that is like entering this new field, because he's going into artificial intelligence and he wants to create videos related to that. And that is what gives you your unique perspective, is you have the beginner's perspective. So, you know, you can't create a YouTube video that's like what I've expert talks about artificial intelligence, because that would just be lying. But you can create something like, you know, 19 hours into this coding course, here's what I've learned, or something like that.
Absolutely.
It's just an absolute mindset shift is what I think it is. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. There's in the beginning of the book, I help people. So I'm a practical dude. Like, I'm not here to inspire you. I'm not here to only inspire without proving it. I really want to bring these ideas down to earth and say, you are creative and here I can prove it. And so if you're willing, I'd like to prove it briefly together for your listeners. Are you down with that?
Let's do it. Yeah, heck yeah.
Okay, cool. So let's do it with you. And you know, this is something that I'm still honing. So I appreciate everybody's open mind and loving hearts as we walk through this, because it's a metaphor that my wife is clearly a star in my life here. She's like, you got to avoid math, man, because you lose people at the math. But again, we're anti Ariana today, man. We're gonna do everything she says not to do. So, all right, I'm gonna ask you for three things that you like, okay? And then we're gonna talk about it. So, give me, and I'm grabbing a piece of paper here because I'm even gonna write this down. I want you to give me, and we're not gonna do your favorite. We're just going to do something you like, because favorites take a lot of deliberation. So name for me a movie that you really like.
The Martian.
Ooh, so good, man. And the book, both. Just awesome. All right, so we'll take The Martian. And then do you like video games by any chance?
I do. Love video games.
Sweet. Name a game that you're a fan of.
Total War Warhammer 2.
Warhammer 2. Awesome. Okay. And then give me a book that you really like.
Thinking Fast and Slow.
Thinking Fast and Slow. I love the cover of that book. All right, so we've got three things that you're into. The Martian, Warhammer 2, Thinking Fast and Slow. So let's imagine, and not, actually let's not imagine, in the real world here, there are thousands of movies, thousands of games, and thousands of books, right? I think our listeners would agree that that is true. We are going to say, let's imagine a world in which there's only 1,000 of each, okay? And there's, of course, we know there's more. But even if there's just 1,000 of each, when you take those three interests and you put them into something that you like, you let them be inspired by something that you create, that means that the permutations go from you being 1 in 8 billion people, because there's 1 billion permutations for just those three things at 1,000 each. You become 1 in 8 people in the world. So when you create by putting your interests, you immediately reduce the amount of other people doing things like you. Okay. You become 1 in 8. And then if you add a fourth item, the permutations become 1 trillion. And that's 128 times the population of the earth. There is no one like you when you take your four interests and put them into what you do. And so exactly what you said about your brother is, hey man, don't try to be someone you're not. Put your personal experience right now, plus this, the interest that you have, plus your personality and the way that you talk, plus your past, you know, studies. And when you combine that into a YouTube channel, there's not going to be anyone like you. And that is a provable way to say that you are unique and the things you create are worth creating. Does that make sense?
I feel like that whole exercise is just actually so good for just understanding the scale at how just having three interests, like we came up with those in like 5 seconds and it wasn't even my favorite. So it was very easy to do. It just shows you like you literally can be a niche of one, even with so many other creators. Cause I think like
absolutely
one of the most common things I hear from people that want to get into some type of creative thing is they're like, what do I have to say that's unique? You know, it hasn't it already been said?
Right.
And it's like, yeah, well, a lot of things have been said, but has it been talked about in the terms of someone who loves video games and this specific one? I don't think so.
Like, say there was something in The Martian, you know, a fascination for space travel to Mars, avoiding disaster, you got from the book, and then you like the UI of Warhammer, and then Thinking Fast and Slow made you approach it in a way where you were like, this is really important to me. The result is going to be super unique. And you know, let's take Baron Fig, for example. You know, Baron Fig sells tools for thinkers, notebooks, pens, all sorts of stuff, guided journals. And when I started that company when I was 26, I basically took my absolute love for notebooks, the blank page, and my passion for philosophy and my interest in business, specifically e-commerce through the internet. And I combined them into Baron Fig. And at the time, we were the only notebook seller on the internet with a brand around it selling, you know, notebooks shipped directly to you. Even Moleskine and Lectrum, which are, of course, big names that we know, they didn't even have e-commerce stores at the time. They had to be pressured into doing that. And so by putting your uniqueness into what you make, it becomes unique.
Ooh, I have a fun question off of that. With all of the interest that I know you have from reading about philosophy and your adventures into books and Seton Hall and literature, how do you think you've incorporated your personal interests, video games, books, movies, and other things into your visual art to create something that just nobody else is creating?
Good question. I think it comes down to all those. I walk towards my influences, and I think a lot of folks think that, oh, I'm pulling from this scene in this movie, I am copying. Well, not really, unless you make the exact movie again and then repeat the scene you're copying. But otherwise, if you're just taking an element, that's inspiration, right? And there's a whole chapter in my book about understanding the difference between inspiration and copying, you know, plagiarism versus connections by piecing things together. And so for me, I always think about, you know, I understand that notebooks and pens are not the most exciting things in the world. And so, but I have these passions for really interesting mediums like movies, which can be, you know, phenomenally thrilling, and video games, which are incredibly immersive. And I take my inspiration and apply it to products. So the best example I can give you is we recently launched a pen called the Oracle Pen. Have you seen it on our website?
I did. I took a little look.
Yeah. Oh, man. If you send me your address, I'll send you one of these. And yeah, this is one of my favorite products we've made. But I feel like every time we release something, I feel like this is my favorite thing. But this pen, we normally have a Squire pen, which is totally round and rolls around and everything. And we thought, what if we made it a six-sided object like a pencil? And then how could we use that to have a reason, and not just a novel, not just like a change for change's sake? And so because we made the pen six-sided like a pencil, when you roll it, it eventually stops on one side. And we thought, wow, what could we do with the different sides? And of course, we came up with the idea of like a magic eight ball. Each side has a different fortune on it. So I'll just read a couple. Ask again. Chances are slim. It is likely. And right. So when you roll the pen, you get, you know, I'll do it right now. Is Aiden having a good time? Without question. Oh, wow. I hope so.
The pen knows.
So basically just taking inspiration wherever I can and not looking at what people are doing with pens and notebooks and saying, well, I have to do that too, because there is no other pen, you know, like this out there, which is why it's selling so well. Does that kind of answer the question? I'm not sure.
No, it totally did. Like, one of the things that I took away from that is, especially with things that have been out for a very long time, like pens, it most people wouldn't come to the creation of a pen with that creative mindset that you're advocating for, of, you know, creating something that is just so different that it might not market to everyone, but it will have a really, really big appeal with a specific group of people. Like, I never thought that a pen could be that interesting, but you've just proven me wrong.
Yeah, there you go. And it's like, it's okay for there are some people I'll show it to and they're like, okay, cool. Like, that's not for me. And that is totally fine. Like, what do I say? There was a part in the book called the glove analogy, which resonates with readers a lot. And it's under the chapter that basically says, you know, if you make for everyone, you appeal to no one. And so imagine a pair of gloves that's so inoffensive that anybody could wear them, right? They're just charcoal or gray or black, totally simple, minimal. The seams are just where they should be. They fit perfectly. Anybody could wear these gloves. Okay. So we have these gloves. And then you would think, wow, if I make these gloves, I can sell it to the whole world because it's just so universally applicable. And you're not wrong. But here's where it gets interesting is, well, when I want to go do gardening, am I going to use these universally simple gloves or am I going to use gardening gloves? I'm going to use gardening gloves. When I want to go beat the crap out of a punching bag, am I going to use these simple gloves or boxing gloves, right? Am I going to use, when it's really cold out, am I going to use these simple gloves or am I going to use the really warm gloves with a contact touch on my pointer finger and thumb so that I can use my iPhone? I'm going to use the latter. And so what happens is this analogy essentially shows that when you create for a very specific niche or a very specific audience or a very specific use, you trump the general use product in the same category every time. And so when we're creating as creators, when we put our unique interests into what we make and we're like, oh no, but what about all the people who don't like what I like? Well, this is an example of why when you put your interests, it works, because the people who try to appeal to everyone are always going to be trumped by those folks who put their really specific opinionated perspectives into something, because that's going to catch the group that would prefer it over the generalized creation. Mm-hmm.
I remember when I first started my YouTube channel 2 years ago, I was creating videos literally called How to Be Productive. And then I would come into this course that I took around 8 months after I first started called the Part-Time YouTuber Academy. And I would say, like, I don't understand. Why am I not getting more viewers? Like, you know, I feel like these videos are pretty good. And then they would be very upfront upfront with me. They're like, yeah, your videos are pretty good, but who are you targeting? Like, productivity is one of the biggest niches there is. And I remember thinking exactly what you just said after I first heard that, like, oh, these guys, what are they talking about? Like, that, you know, if I niche down, who am I going to be targeting? But I decided to do an experiment where I would create a few videos for a couple of weeks that were just really, really specific and see what would happen. And I created a video called How to Use the Zettelkasten Method of Note-Taking as a Student, which is like, in Obsidian. In Obsidian. It's like literally the most niche thing you could, it's so niche. Like, first of all, you have to be using Obsidian, the note-taking app. Second, you have to know what the Zettelkasten method is, which is a niche note-taking method as well. And then it's also oriented towards college students. And it absolutely exploded, like way more so than any other thing that I'd made. And it really made me realize exactly what you just said, which is when you create for a specific niche, you're not inhibiting your ability to reach people. You're actually making it better. And It's something that I think you don't realize until you start seeing the results from that niching down.
That's amazing. Wow. So I'm so glad you shared that. I'm gonna tell you a secret that's not going to be a secret after I tell you this, which is part of what I'd like to do with Baron Fig going forward. I would like to experiment with courses and sharing, you know, what I've learned, but then I'll make a bunch of courses myself, but then Baron Fig team members. And then also, you know, I've been doing this for over 10 years. All the folks that I have met along the way who I think would be really good on in front of the camera and have something to share. So here's my question for you is, if I want to lay down a foundation of courses, so I'm going over how to do this, do I start with how to be more, like, let's just say, how to be more creative and how to be more productive because I'm selling to my audience? Or let me stop there. As someone who's asking, I'm asking you for advice. What do you think I should do as Baron Fig who wants to experiment with some video courses?
Ooh, wow. Yeah. Well, first off, thanks for asking. I think the route I would go down, having just finished creating my first digital course, is what I've noticed a lot of new course creators will do. Is they will create something specific and then they will bundle a large amount of courses together into something greater. So to give you an example, one of the best course creators I've ever seen, his name is Anthony Metvier. I had him on a podcast a few days ago. And he created a course called, he creates courses on memory to try and help people learn how to improve their memory, how to memorize numbers, words, poetry, entire books even. And wow. What he's done is he started creating courses by choosing one of those specific things. So like how to boost memory as a student for numbers, how to memorize formulas for your chemistry classes or for any like math classes, how to memorize faces, how to memorize poetry. And then what he does is he...
Mm-hmm. Sorry, the ones that you're naming, are those courses like as in a collection of videos or a single video each?
Those are collections of videos, I believe. Like wow, they're okay. Each... Yeah, I think they're each like an hour or so long. And then what he did is he combined them all into what he calls the magnetic memory method and bundled them. So essentially what ends up happening is a person comes in with a very specific problem. Say they really want to learn how to memorize numbers for their math classes. They take one of his courses and they're like, oh, this is phenomenal. Well, now I'm interested in all these other courses on memory, which I wasn't interested at first in. And if you think about it, it's exactly like any other content creation medium, like a YouTube channel, for instance, where someone comes in, a new subscriber, to watch a YouTube video. Maybe they came for a specific problem that your video answered. They watch it. Then because they got integrated into your personality, they start to understand who you are. Now they're interested in all these other videos on your channel that they would not have watched if they hadn't taken that one video. So I think what I'm trying to say is I would not overthink the course creation process by trying to create like the master course, the largest course you possibly could right off the bat. Instead, I would try and create something small, something specific, so as to not be a perfectionist, and then try and build up over time, maybe even bundle things together. But that's just my advice.
That's really insightful. I have yet to hear that suggestion, so that's super useful to really ponder because it does make sense and it fits my principles. and how I create. Cool. Good advice.
Well, I have a question for you based off of wanting to create the courses. Is what do you think is motivating you to dive into the course creation as a medium?
Great question. Well, I personally really enjoy sharing things I've learned. I don't want to say I'm natural. I would say it's a natural inclination. It's a better way of saying it. Like what I see someone doing something, I'm like, hey, let me tell you what I've learned, because then you don't have to suffer as much as I did to figure out how to get there. And so it seems like a natural, thing for me to formalize and move into. And then Baron Fig is, my mission is still to champion thinkers, you know, in their endeavors. And so I could do that with physical tools, or I could do that with digital tools, which, you know, digital tools come in a couple formats. There's software and there's videos. And so, you know, I don't want to go and create software. That's a bit of a big endeavor. And I think there's a lot of great things already out there. But I do believe that videos make sense for our brand. It's also a rather inexpensive thing to test. When you think about, like, you know, this pen for us to make, let's say it was $20,000 or $30,000 of effort to get to market, whereas a course is a fraction of that to test and try. So the reasons, if I boiled it down, it would be like, number one, I think we could do a pretty good job and we have stuff to say. And number two, compared to what we already do, it's a no-brainer in terms of a business experiment.
I think that what you said about the cost is very insightful, because that's one of the things that really hit me as I'm getting closer to finishing my first digital course. It's called Obsidian University, all about like orienting students towards using Obsidian, the note-taking tool. And I'm realizing, like, because it's literally just a folder, like the whole course is just a folder. It's not like a video course hosted on a platform. It is literally an Obsidian vault. I don't know if you know what Obsidian is, but essentially it's a note-taking app that just uses your folders on your local hard drive to take notes in. So every time you create a note, it creates a new note in a folder on your local hard drive. So like the cost of like creating the course has been basically $0. Because it's like you just write on your computer and then you sell the folder. So I totally agree with what you're saying. Like, you know, the pen sounds awesome, but a digital product, it's like, it's profound the level of scale you can get to without being inhibited by the cost of the product itself.
Absolutely. And there's also an added bonus, which is that it is, how do I say this? The success of a digital product is opaque rather than transparent. And so what I mean by that is, when we make a digital course, once we do it and we upload it and it's on our website, unlike our physical products, there's no inventory that we have to re-up. And there's no shipping. Whether we sell, and what I mean by the success is whether I sell one or 1,000, it is only additive and it causes no negative issues. Whereas if I make this pen and if I sell one versus 1,000, say I made 1,000 of them, if I only sell one, I have 999 on the shelf that are still, that still represent quite a bit of money that now I have to figure out how to convert back to cash if it's not selling, which is an incredible problem if that happens. And so for business-wise, it just makes a lot of sense. And I wouldn't do it if I didn't think, though, it was a good idea beyond a business move. So there are plenty of things that I, you know, business moves I could do that I don't feel strongly about, but this I do. Like, I think my heart's in it, and then my mind is in it as well.
That is awesome. I would love to hear more about how the course creation goes as you start getting into it, because as someone whose life has been changed by like taking lots of courses online, I would even say, don't tell my university professors this, but More so than my college classes.
I very much
love the idea of creating a course out of the book, or something related to it. One of the questions that I wanted to ask, going back to the discussion we were having earlier on creativity as it relates to the book, is out of all of the laws of creativity you discuss in the book, do you think there was any that particularly resonated with you on a deeper level?
That's a really good question. There was one that that really got me. I'm trying to think of the name of the actual law, because it was what I learned while researching Bruce Lee. It's in chapter 28. It's called Adapt to Circumstance. For everyone out there, I should probably say the book's divided into three parts. There's foundation, process, and then excellence. So foundation, we discussed earlier, it kind of reorients your mind. Process actually teaches you how to create from start to finish. And then in part three, which I decided to add towards the end of the process, is it's about excellence. So I have the unique, the unique benefit, the good luck to collaborate with incredible people over the years, like top of their class illustrators, designers, writers, and so forth. And so I've been exposed to the habits and the beliefs and the principles and the methods of super high achievers. And so I put this, what I learned, into part three, excellence. And so there's a chapter 28 that really changed a bit of how I approach life. And for each chapter, there's a law, a story, an explanation, and then what I call, it's not in the book, but I call it Joey time, which is like me kind of adding all these thoughts and whatnot into it. Okay, here's the one, and it's called The Law of Growth. Learning has no limits. Don't be content to master one skill and neglect others. Without diversification, your strengths can turn into weaknesses. Commit to being a student for life. And so I did this story about Bruce Lee. Are you familiar with like Bruce Lee's Jeet Kune Do?
Yes. Yeah.
Cool. So I'll briefly tell the story to your listeners, which is Bruce Lee was born in Hong Kong, and he was kind of a small kid, and he got beat up. And so his parents sent him to learn martial arts. And then he became so good because he had a reason to, because he wanted to stop getting his butt kicked. And he got so good that he beat the crap out of all the kids on the street. And the police came to his parents and were like, your kid is now go from the kid being bullied to the biggest bully on the block. And if something doesn't change, we are going to have to put him in prison. And so, yeah, so Bruce Lee had a reason. He became incredibly disciplined. They sent him to America with family. He started a dojo, and he was the first person who decided that he was going to teach martial arts to anybody who wanted to learn. And his martial art was, he called it Gung Fu with a G. It's Kung Fu. It's just a different way of saying it, but he preferred the G. So he taught Gung Fu to anybody who would learn. Well, that really agitated a lot of the local masters, because they felt the only people that should be taught their traditional martial art were other Chinese people. And Bruce Lee said, that's not how I'm operating, man. I accept everyone. So this one particular master challenged Bruce Lee. His name was Wong Jack Man. And he said, look, man, we're going to do a one-on-one, and I want to whoop your ass. And if I win, you're going to stop teaching. And Bruce Lee was like, let's just do our own thing. Don't worry about it. And Wong Jack Man was pretty much like, oh yeah, you're afraid, aren't you? And he sort of bullied Bruce Lee into this fight. And so they decided to do this fight privately. There were only like five or six people who attended. But the story goes that the fight ended in 30 seconds. Bruce Lee overpowered Wong Jack Man so quickly that Wong Jack Man actually turned around and ran. Bruce Lee jumped on his back, beat the back of his head down onto the floor, and kept punching him until Wong Jackman said, "I surrender."
Oh my
God. And this all happened. Yeah. Super quick. And so, pretty wild story. And this is where it gets interesting. So a few months later, Bruce Lee comes out and declares, "I am no longer committed to Kung Fu. I am now committed to this thing he called Jeet Kune Do, which means the way of the intercepting fist." And he said, I forget the exact terminology. It is essentially the art of no art, in terms of it is no longer about mastering any single martial art. And people are like, "What are you talking about? Like, you just absolutely destroyed Wong Jack Man using Kung Fu mastery." And as it turns out, Bruce Lee had an epiphany, which is that Wong Jack Man was a master of Shaolin martial arts. Bruce Lee was a master of Kung Fu. And what he realized is that when you are a master, the only reason he beat Wong Jack Man was because he just happened to be the beneficiary of a misaligned match. So let's take rock, paper, scissors, for example. Rock always beats scissors, scissors always beats paper, paper always beats rock. Bruce Lee just happened to be rock that would beat scissors in this case. And he realized this, like the way Kung Fu works, Shaolin martial art just cannot fight it. However, if he had fought someone who, let's say it was like Brazilian jiu-jitsu or a grappling martial art, he could have been on the other end where his mastery just doesn't have the tools to fight this other one. And so he ditched everything and he decided to create Jeet Kune Do, which is not a single practice, but a philosophy, the philosophy of learning everything. And then he started doing boxing and karate and also even fencing to learn what he could from fencing. And what he did became the foundation. And Bruce Lee is considered the father, the godfather of mixed martial arts, is where you now come and learn everything. And so for me, to answer your question, for me is what, when I read that and when I really learned and understood, I realized that my discipline, which I had, you know, had, I don't want to say had been proud of, I'm still proud of being a disciplined individual that I've like worked up to, but my discipline can also be my greatest weakness, so that when I am so disciplined that if something comes along and says, "Hey, I know you plan to do this, but this needs attention." Previously, I would be like, "Okay, well, that's against my discipline. So I'm going to stay disciplined and focus, and then I'll deal with this other thing later." And that could cause problems. And so my greatest strength is also my greatest weakness. And when I read that and I understood that, I started to change my approach to life, that I can be disciplined, but I also can be flexible. And the single lesson that I got from my own book has changed my life significantly in the last year that I have been practicing it. And so that really got me.
That was an incredible story. And I really want to hear, after hearing how you've changed your whole attitude towards life with that story in the book, can you give us some examples of something that you might not have done in the last year if you didn't have that mindset, and how it helped you?
Yeah, sure. It's a lot of stuff to do with my personal life rather than work. At work, there aren't so many unexpected things that come that I'm not prepared for. And there are also other folks to take away those things if they come. But in my personal life, it's me and my wife. And so my inflexibility really caused problems at home. For example, if I wanted to work out, you know, in the morning, and I wanted to do, you know, I'll do, let's say, 4 days a week, 6 a.m. Well, if something happened in the morning where my wife, you know, had a phone call early, you know, I would get upset and be like, "Hey, come on, you know, it's my workout day. Like, you need to like still follow through on your commitment, take the dog out, Luigi, do those things." And now, I know it's so small, but it's such a profound change, is now if that comes up, I'm like, "Hey, don't worry about it. I'll walk Luigi and I'll go to the gym 15 minutes later." And like, it's so insignificant, but it's so profoundly different in our relationship and in my, I'm not a stressed out guy in general. So like, I went from like a 3 out of 10 to like a 1 by adopting this. And so that's to give you an example, was the gym thing is really a strong recurring instance where I changed big time.
Wow. Yeah. And you know, it's funny because it seems like such a small thing, but in actuality, that small thing, if you do that for years and years, is going to add up to so much in your relationship.
Yeah.
100%. Oh, yeah.
Like, I mean, you know, Ariana would be rightfully ticked off, where she'd be like, dude, come on, just freaking do it, man. It's like so easy. Like, I have a phone call, and I'd be like, no, why? You know, I go to the gym. Why would you, and it's like ridiculous, but I had been so protective of my discipline. And so like I identified with my discipline, and I had to let that go and say, I am not Joey, the disciplined person. I am Joey who employs discipline and employs flexibility, and separate myself from that. And it's still something I'm working on, but it's a really useful change.
I really resonate with that story, because I remember at the start of COVID-19, I felt I had so much more time, and I decided, what should I do with that time? Oh, I'll lose the 30 extra pounds I thought I had. So I went on YouTube and I searched up how to lose weight fast, the greatest thing to do. And I started doing this thing called the anabolic diet, which is essentially a diet where you eat as high protein, as high volume, and as routinely as possible. So I'd eat like exactly every 3 hours, same meals every single day on all the time. And I became like this really structured, routined, disciplined person. But I noticed that over time, it had an incredibly negative effect on my relationships. Because, for example, one day I was cooking dinner with my family, and my mom brought out this tray of like roasted Brussels sprouts. I love roasted Brussels sprouts. And then I noticed there was like this glaze over them. And I was like, what is that? She's like, oh, it's coconut oil. And I was like, coconut oil? You mean that stuff that's really high calorie? I can't have that. So then I literally like took my own Brussels sprouts, put them in the oven, and ate them without any oil on them whatsoever. And over time, like just this need to stick to this routine, this schedule, just made life awful. Like I couldn't do anything spontaneous, couldn't hang out with friends if it was over 3 hours. It was truly terrible. And I remember there was one day where I was sitting on my couch like 3 months into this whole endeavor, and I was so tired that I couldn't even get up to make myself the meal that I would have had at that time. And I knew something needed to change then. And to this day, it's been like a year and a half since that time. But I have like ingrained a much more just spontaneous go with the flow, while still having like a routine and habits that I have, just not nearly as rigorous as what it was before. So in many ways, a similar transformation to you.
Yeah. Wow. That's a great story. The Brussels sprouts really stood out, man. Yeah. I can relate big time. I eat similarly too, where I eat every 6 hours, and, I mean, sorry, 6 times a day, every 3 hours. And, I had to learn to be flexible in the exact same way you did, because it was starting to interfere with my life, my relationship, having fun. Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy how we can get swept up in things.
Is there anything else that you changed as a person as a result of writing the book?
That's a good question. I think as a result of writing the book, I would say that I changed my approach towards what I need to do for Baron Fig to be the right type of leader. And by that, I mean like more in front of people like we're doing right now. More of like, okay, it's time for me to go and talk to folks and like be the face of Baron Fig. Whereas in 2013, the landscape of business was different. There was storytelling, but it wasn't nearly as much. There were very few founders going and acting as personalities to bring in folks through storytelling on video and social media. It was a different landscape 10 years ago, a decade. A lot has changed. And back then I was always like, you know what? I'm totally comfortable being on stage and being on camera and being on the mic, like totally comfortable, but I don't seek it out because I like to just create so much. I like creating. I like sitting at my desk with my notebook and my computer creating. And so that always overpowered any desire to be in front of people. So writing this book, and I realized I have to, if I'm doing this, I have to represent it myself. Baron Fig can't be the middleman to say, here's the new product, because this product has literally got my name on it. And so, you know, not what's in the book, this is to answer like not what's in the book, like a law, but just making the book, that changed me as a business individual and as a founder to start going out and saying, all right, it's time to use these other skills I have, like, you know, being a good time, you know, dude, chatting it up. And then that led to the course as well. It's like, screw it. You know, people love what I've got to say, or, you know, people seem to like, I don't say they love, hey, Joe, you the man, but they seem to enjoy, you know, all the feedback is like, I love the podcast, man. It's so great. You know, unsolicited. And so, okay, cool. Well, I'll try being in front of the camera for a product. And that became the course idea. So writing the book has directly affected my willingness to experiment with changing up the business in a way in which I will be in the next 12 months, I will be far more visible. Whereas right now, if you go to baronfig.com, you will not see me anywhere on the homepage. You really will see me in like one spot if you look, but otherwise, you know, within the site, but otherwise it's not visible at all who does this. Whereas there are brands now, and the strategy now, if you've got a founder who can be that person, that is a winning strategy for connecting with people. And it makes sense. People love people. You know, Apple is a great example. We all know, like, people love to see Steve Jobs on stage talking it up. And, you know, people, whether you love them or hate them, people are gravitate towards Elon Musk getting on camera and talking about all sorts of things. And so, you know, over time, so over the last 10 years, it's become clear that that's a new approach. And so that's something that the book has taught me, you know, on more of a meta level rather than what's inside of it.
Yeah, it sounds almost like writing the book and then hearing all the people that have said how much they love it has given you some confidence to put yourself out as a more visible part of Baron Fig.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's going to be cool. I will always, you know, my people who know me very well joke that you could lock me up in a room with no windows for a year and I would still have a blast. Like, I don't need to travel. I don't need to go see people. Like, I just, as long as I have my computer, my notebook, I'm just like a pig in mud. However, what I'm about to embark on, starting with this book, is going to change that fundamentally. And we'll see how it goes, but I'm up for the challenge.
Oh, that's exciting. It's going to be like an experiment and going away from like how it's been so far, where, you know, you're spending a lot more time just in the muck and the weeds of being creative at your desk. Now it's going to be like more of the building that persona. Oh, that's so cool. I have a question, which is, now that it's been a few months after you've written the book and you've gotten some feedback from people, it clearly a lot of it's been positive. Is there anything you wish you had changed now?
Great question. So I got two things for you. One, I think you're going to really like, which is, it involves Notion. Okay. And how terrible Notion spell check is. So I know it's like a dig on Notion. I wrote the entire book in an app called Ulysses. Are you familiar with it?
Yes.
Cool. Yeah. It's wonderfully minimal, easy to organize. Chapters are like in individual pages. Definitely don't write, you know, for people who want to write a book out there, do not use Microsoft Word or Google Docs. It's really limiting. Whereas something like Ulysses, you can reorganize your chapters on the fly. It's awesome. Anyway, so I wrote my whole book in Ulysses, which was great for spell checking. Totally, totally nailed that. And then, there are a dozen or so images in the, I should say graphs in the book that I had to design and then to give to the person laying out the book. And so I wrote the captions for those in Notion. Well, Notion did not spell check. It did not put that little red line under my word that said, "Hey man, look at this." And I assumed it would, because sometimes it does. And so if anyone wants to go buy the book and hunt for the pictures, you will probably find a misspelled word in about a third of them. And it bums me out so much that made it into the book. So I will be updating those on the next printing, which is coming up very, very soon. So that's number one. I want to change that, because that's a real bummer. Goddamn Notion. And then number two,
Notion.
Yeah, I know. Notion, come on. And number two is, I did a ton of research for this book, like more research than writing. And one thing I messed up, and the only email I ever got for someone to say, "Hey, this is wrong," I named Elon Musk the founder of Tesla, because he calls himself the founder of Tesla. If you Google him or look at he presents himself as that, when actually technically he did not found the company. I think he invested in it early on, and then when it was getting success, he took it over. But there were other people who founded it. And so minor, but I would like to go and just update the one sentence in the book that says that, to be a little bit more specific. That's it. But otherwise, I'm very happy with how it came out. I never could have imagined that it would hit number one on Amazon, that so many people would read it, that it would be so long. You know, I didn't imagine it would be 400 pages, but the chapters are so short. They're like 8 to 10 pages a pop. People say they fly through it because it's so easy to pick up and just read a chapter. So I'm pleasantly surprised with what I ended up with, other than those two things.
To have those be the only two things that you'd like to change, I think is a very, great indication of just how much research and time you spent refining the writing. And a question I had related to that idea of is how you balance doing with, how do I word this? How do you overcome perfectionism when you're creating something? Because in a lot of the creative, a lot of creative acts that I've done, every single time I've published something to the internet, there's always a feeling of that could have been better if I spent another few weeks or a few days or whatever.
Yeah.
But obviously that wouldn't be good advice for every single thing.
Yeah. So great question. This is one of my favorite subjects too. And I have a personal attachment to it because one of my friends, I'm just going to call his ass out right now. One of my friends from college has been writing a book for 10 years. Okay.
I've
gently tried to encourage him to be a little more disciplined. I've offered help. I've offered even like, I don't want to say financial help, but I've offered to like use some of Baron Fig's resources to help edit it. And he still hasn't published it. And I even, you know, I basically challenged him, and he was like 8 years into his book. And I said, "Hey man, I'm going to write a book and publish it before you're done with yours." And he was like, "Nah, dude." And I was like, "No, watch, I'm going to show you how it's done." And so I wrote my book in 11 months and, you know, had it published in like, I don't know, 16 months or something, whatever it was. And so I have a serious connection towards this idea of perfection, because he kept saying it has to be perfect. It has to be perfect. And that's just not true. And so there's a chapter in this book that I wrote to him in my mind without naming him. And it's called Publish Imperfection. And it's the law of good enough, which says aim for perfection and you will find yourself smothered by perpetual searching and disappointment. Instead, publish the simplest, clearest version of your creation and go from there. And so, of course, it's the idea that if you aim for perfection, there's only two results that you're going to get. Okay? Result number one is perfection is endlessly pursued, because there's no such thing as perfect. You will never finish. Okay? That's where he's at. The other result is number two, an imperfect creation is reluctantly published. So if you can't get over it, then you don't even like the thing you publish, because you're so upset that it's not perfect, when we know that perfect isn't real. And so I address this, you know, through something called the Platonic Forms. Have you ever heard of that? So there's, we all know the philosopher Plato. So he came up with this thing called the Forms, which we call the Platonic Forms, aka Plato's Forms, which is a form is the idea of something in your head versus reality. And so let's take in the book I say, let's take the form of a circle. In your mind, it is perfect. Every point is absolutely equidistant from the center. However, in reality, that is impossible to create. But it doesn't prevent us from using circles everywhere we look. So, and then I point out, like, in the room right now, look at your coffee mug, look at your lamp, look at your water bottle, look at your, you know, I am using one of these circle lights here. There's circles everywhere, but they're not perfect. But people said it's good enough. And so that is how you have to look at your creations and say, I'm never going to get it to be perfect. But if I'm the only person that notices the imperfections, that's good enough. Does that make sense?
That totally makes sense. It's not like we're agonizing over the fact that every circle we see is not like perfectly equidistant. It's it's just the fact that it's our creation that makes us think it needs to be the best it is. And I think the funny thing is, one of the things you're hitting on is like, because we're so in depth in the work that we're creating, we know like every single aspect that has gone into creating it. So we're more cognizant of some of the imperfections in it. I'm not saying like an outside perspective isn't useful, but so we can tend to think like, oh, this isn't perfection. Whereas someone else will see it and they'll be like, oh, this is great.
Exactly.
Yeah. Totally agree. Well, is there something, before I ask my last question, that you wish I had asked that I've not asked yet?
I mean, there's so much, you know, there's a whole book's worth of stuff I could talk about. I think, if I had to say one thing is that, you know, for one thing I do try to spread, which is that the word, thoughts about the word weird, okay, weird has been weaponized, and it's really sad that that is the case. And like I said earlier, I like to bring things down to earth and prove it. So, you know, we could say here, think about a person in school that was different from everyone else. You know, when we were kids, you know, they go, oh, that's the weird kid, right? Or, you know, when you're in the workplace and people say, oh, that's the weird person, don't eat lunch with them. Weird is used as a weapon there. It's used as a thing to separate folks, to ostracize them. But actually, weird means you're different, and different means you're unique, and unique means you are original. And that is what everybody wants to be, is original. And, you know, it's odd because we live in a bubble. Everybody has like the world that they occupy, you know, which is maybe 5 square miles that you live in a daily basis or a weekly basis. And within that world, we don't want weird. We want to beat everybody into conformity so that we are comfortable. But here's the interesting thing. Outside of our bubble, we really like weird. And like, don't take my word for it. Like, I'm going to name a few people. They're not necessarily, you know, I have any strong feelings towards, but Kanye West, Elon Musk, Oprah, Martha Stewart, Tom Cruise, whoever you're into, they are all really, really unique and weird people. And we worship them for it. So we have this hypocritical view on life, which is, when you're outside of my bubble, I want you to be weird and different and interesting. But when you're in my life, I don't want any of that. And that's why the word weird is weaponized. So there's a disconnect there. And I just want to share that with everyone who's listening so that you start to think about, you know, what it really means to be weird. And the weird person, that that kid that was weird, or that person at work that is weird, in my mind, in Joey's mind, is the person that's the bravest, because they have decided to be themselves even when other people are knocking them down for that. So think about that, everybody. That's the only thing I want to add.
I think that's such a good thing to note, because I think a lot of people, like you said, they tend to think of weird as like at having a negative connotation, which is hypocritical considering the fact that, like you just said, if it's outside of our bubble, it's a good thing. Whereas if it's inside, it's bad. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
wild.
My last question, this is always a difficult one, is what are 3 books which have resonated with you most?
Ooh, 3 books. This is great. I'm going to actually pull up my Zettelkasten for my books here.
Oh, wait. Oh, so you actually knew what that was.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I will pull up. Here are my top rated books. Let's see. Oh, there's so many. So I'll give you 3. Oh, this is tough. 3 fiction or nonfiction. You have a preference?
I think you should do both, like maybe 2 fiction or 1 nonfiction or 2 nonfiction, 1 fiction, something like that.
All right. I'll do 1 fiction since, you know, people usually listen to learn, and then I'll give 2 nonfiction. So my 1 fiction that I want to share with everyone is American Gods by Neil Gaiman. Have you read it?
Yep. Yeah, I have.
Phenomenal book where
very good.
Literally takes like all the weird things about American society and puts gods to them, sort of like the Greek and Roman cultures had a god of wine and a god of the ocean. Well, he makes like the god of gambling and the god of the internet and creates a story with that. And it is just really interesting and entertaining and eye-opening and talks. It's a good commentary on American society. And then 2 books that are nonfiction. I'm going to go with, what can I say that may not have been said before? They're all so good. I'll take a turn here and I'll say Green Lights by Matthew McConaughey. Have you read that?
No.
So that's a good one. In terms of like the Matthew McConaughey that we think we know, it's really interesting to see. You know, he had a rough growing up, and by no means privileged, but it's entertaining. He's not like trying to be like, woe is me. And I think if you're someone who's really curious about ways in which family can interact and work, and hard work can pay off, it's a good book. And going with the flow and taking something that's could be seen as a negative and making it a positive, i.e. like going from a red light to a green light, as he says. And I recommend the audiobook for that. And then as the third and nonfiction book, I'm going to say, I was an English major, by the way. This is like a serious question for me. So I will just say, again, I'll go for one that I don't think people have read. I'm going to recommend Damn Good Advice by George Lois. So George Lois is one of the original Mad Men. And he is one of the guys that the show Mad Men is based on. It was the original Madison Avenue advertising guy. I met him in person. He came to my school. I got a signed book, talked to him for a little while. And it's a small book, super short, where he gives his damn good advice about doing good work and making things. It's an easy read. It's like literally a small book, as in like it's the size of a postcard dimensions. And there's like, I don't know, 50 or 100 little principles, one on each page. And it's so entertaining and so insightful. I highly recommend it. Oh, and number four, The Laws of Creativity by Joey
Carpenter. Oh, you sneaky, sneaky.
Got it in there.
I've never read that book. Who's that from?
You should check that out. Heard it's pretty good.
I love all those recommendations. I've heard of all of them, but I've only read American Gods. So that is awesome. Yeah. Where can people listening to the podcast reach you outside?
Cool. So you can go to my website, joeycapone.com, and you'll see the book. You can go to visit Baron Fig through there. And on Twitter or Instagram, you can do @joeycapone, and you can say hello or check out what I'm up to.